Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and this is the Downtime Podcast, where I take you behind the scenes of downhill and enduro mountain biking and meet some of the characters involved in making the sport as great as it is. This episode of the podcast is supported by Cushcore. I've been using Cushcore for over a year now and I love the ride characteristics that it gives, providing damping, allowing the bike to maintain momentum better over rough terrain and providing more support in the turns. Cushcore really does allow you to go bigger, corner harder and ride faster with total confidence, so it's not surprising to see the list of top riders who are using them continuing to grow, with names like Loic Bruni and Martin Mays amongst them. If you've not listened to our episode with Cushcore inventor and founder Adam Crefton, then you should, as it was one of our most popular episodes of last year and explains why not all inserts are made equal. You can find that at downtimepodcast.com/Cushcore. To get your hands on some for yourself, then just head to Cushcore.com. If you fancy the chance to win a set of Cushcore in your chosen size, then all you've got to do is to spend a couple of minutes helping me out. I want to find out a bit more about my listeners, not only to help make better content for you, but also to help when I'm talking to brands about supporting the podcast, which is ultimately what keeps this thing going. So I have a short listener survey over on my website at downtimepodcast.com/survey that I'd love for you to fill in. Everyone who does so and enters an email address will automatically be entered into the prize draw for your very own set of Cushcore, which will transform your ride. Don't worry, I won't be sharing your personal information with anyone, as all the privacy info is at the top of the form. You'll also find a link to the survey in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. Apologies, but unfortunately all of our merch sales are on hold due to suppliers shutting to stop the spread of the virus. You can, however, still make a Share the Love donation over at downtimepodcast.com/shop, and t-shirts and that kind of stuff should be back once things get a bit more normal again. Please keep on spreading the word and making sure all your riding mates are listening to the podcast. And don't forget to give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. All right, this week on the podcast, I'm joined by Richard Cunningham. Richard has an amazing story from being part of the group of people who got mountain biking started, through his time as a bike builder, his move to print journalism, and then onto the world of online with Pink Bike. Richard is a great storyteller with plenty to share, including being a self-taught pilot. Think about that one for a second. How mountain biking has progressed as a sport, making big career moves, predicting the future, and plenty more. So without further ado, here's Richard Cunningham. Richard Cunningham, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
Pretty good, Chris. It's unusual to be on this side of the podcast. Normally, I'm on the listening side.
Good stuff. All right, well, let's wind the clock back and start where we start most of these episodes. Tell us a little bit about your childhood and how bikes fitted into that, because we're talking pre-mountain bikes at this point in time, yeah?
Yeah, I would say I'm going to start with Ian Ritz from Cro-Mag. He put the entire mountain bike experience, the cycling experience, in one paragraph. He said, bicycles give superpowers. He said that you can jump higher, you can fly farther, you can go 10 times faster. And all you do is just put this little mechanism on and it just amplifies your experience. And so my beginning into mountain bike started as a child, because I'm the oldest of 8 kids. And we didn't have a lot of money and we didn't go a lot of places. So when I got my first bike, my world went from 2 neighborhoods to orange groves and dirt roads and farms. And I just started going everywhere. It was like freedom and flying at the same time, because I'd never gone that fast in my life. And I never made those swoopy turns. And so for me, it was just this, the first time I felt individualized and free on this bicycle.
Can you remember what age you were when you first started to get on a bike?
I was late on a bike. I was probably like 6. So okay. My freedom part was when I was about 7 or 8 or 9. My family, we lived in the edge of the country, so we could just disappear and come back for lunch or dinner.
Nice.
So I was pretty young.
Yeah, that's awesome. But you also, I guess, before kind of bikes really became a real love for you, aeroplanes was a big thing for you. How did you get into that?
Well, I think I wanted to fly from when I could remember myself. It's just something that I dreamed about flying, and I still do. And I built airplanes out of pallets and sticks and pieces of tubing and visqueen and things that I found around, and tried to make airplanes that would fly when I was at, you know, 10 or 12. My mom said she'd give me $50 if I could make an airplane that worked. But aside from a bunch of wrecks, I never got into the air until an accidental day. So I've always wanted to fly.
Yeah. And is there a story with a patio umbrella? Am I right?
So you got to realize that I was the littlest person in school. I went to parochial school. And when we had processions, they went from smallest to largest. And I was always the first boy because I was the littlest person. So I used to, on the way to school, I used to walk, obviously, as the old days. And I used to go through the rubbish on trash day and pick out things like lawnmower engines or wheels or things like that for projects. And I found this gigantic patio umbrella. And I thought, wow, I could probably make this into like a little gliding device if I bent the front stays back and twisted them up and made kind of an airfoil. And in North Orange County, where I lived in Southern California, they had these massive winds called Santa Anas, and they were regular. They'd blow for about a week at 30 miles an hour steady. And behind my school, there was a steep embankment that they had excavated and abandoned that went directly into the wind. So I hid the umbrella in the next to the embankment. And after school, I held onto the umbrella and I ran. I waited for the wind to be as fast as it would go at the top of the hill. And this is about a 30-degree incline. You've seen the inclines when they terrace houses and stuff. So it was pretty steep. But I would throw myself over the cliff and into the wind. And I would just crash and tumble and crash and tumble. And this the last time because it ended in disaster as well. The wind must have just gone super fast because the umbrella took me off the ground, and I was about 2 feet above the embankment for almost the entire distance. And wow. Then when I hit the bottom, I was probably going 10 or 11 miles an hour, and I just – everything. It was just a mess. There was wires and – pieces everywhere, and I was bleeding from many parts, and I was like the happiest boy on earth. And I told my mom I actually flew and explained the story, and she said, "Yes, dear, what would you like for dinner?"
Amazing. How did it feel then to fly for that first time? You'd obviously dreamt about it for so long.
It was fleeting because it was like a second or two, but maybe a second only, but it was just this, you know, being not in contact with the ground is so soft and wonderful. And anyway, it was, for me, it was just that great moment. And it wouldn't be till much later that I actually got to fly something. But that was my first.
Yeah. And so you learned to fly in a plane that your dad built. Am I right?
Yes. My first actual flight was hang gliding.
Okay.
And it was, a neighbor said, "Hey, I got a hang glider and I want you to come out and go fly." And I had no idea how to fly it. So I had a truck. He didn't. And it's the same as shuttling. You shuttle to the top and fly to the bottom. And it was in the early days, so there wasn't much soaring involved. And he basically said, "You push this forward, you pull this back. And when you want to turn, you move the bar from side to side." And that was my instruction for my first flight. And it went well. I landed perfectly and we flew all day, and it was wonderful. But I actually learned the basics in my father's ultralight. So I'm a self-taught pilot, which I would not recommend.
Yeah. So this is a single seater plane. You don't need a license or anything to fly it. You just hop in and work it out.
Yes. Basically a lawn chair with wings and a lot of wires and a noisy engine. And there's just one seat, so you can't get instruction, really. You just have to read a book or have somebody go through the basics. And I thought, well, people fly. They survive. I should be able to do this. And I was pretty scared. I got to tell you, I wanted something to break on the airplane so I didn't have to fly that day. Because now the reality is I have to do it, right? Yeah. So I finally sat in the thing and I pushed the throttle forward and more and more and more. And then I pulled back on the stick and then I was in the air. And I'm like, oh no. So I flew straight, just straight and level with my hands holding the stick like it would fall off if I didn't grab it hard. And then I realized I'm not going to be able to land this thing out in the middle of the desert. I'm going to have to come back to the dry lake at some point. And so I had to learn how to turn. And I'm moving the stick over and I'm fiddling with the pedals and I made these gigantic turns, but they were so big by the time I got turned around, it was over the dry lake and back in the desert again. So I flew around in these gigantic circles until I realized that someday I'm going to have to learn how to land. So it might as well be now. And so I came in really slow and steady and messed with the throttles. And eventually the wheels touched the earth and I came to the ground and I went, well, that's it. You know, and like most pilots on their first solo, the last thing I ever wanted to do was get back in the plane and fly again. It took me a few more days to digest before I realized I wanted to do it again.
Amazing. So are you naturally a brave person? Do you deal with fear well?
I deal with catastrophe well.
Okay.
But I don't deal with fear any better than I think anybody else does. It always eggs me on. It's always been the back.
So how do you process? You say you're good with catastrophe. That's a pretty unusual thing to hear someone say. Tell us a bit more about what you mean and how you approach that.
Well, I think it's because, you know, in a big family, you know, with four brothers and three sisters, you know, you're in that role. You got to take care of whatever comes up. You know, somebody breaks an arm, you got to know who to call. And you have to do it at a pretty young age. I mean, it's like 10 years old. You're taking care of the family. You got a kid in your arm and bottle feeding them and stuff. And so I've got that thing. But what happens, and I'm not sure where it came from, but if something goes really bad, like a car accident or, you know, somebody slices open a wound and we're stuck in the middle of nowhere, it's kind of a panic situation. I just kind of go catatonic almost. It just gets really calm and quiet for me. So yeah. I can take care of the necessary steps in a tragedy type situation, which has happened a few times, and worry about it later, you know. The next day I'm all nerves and stuff, but as far as, you know, jumping a jump you've never done or dropping a drop that looks pretty scary you've never done before, I deal with fear like anybody else. You just figure it out and then move forward and see what happens, you know. But remember one drop I did in Sedona early on. It was pretty big. I just shut my eyes and went over because I figured gravity is going to take over anyway. And when I hit the bottom, I opened my eyes up and I'm like, hey, okay.
That works.
I can do this again.
Excellent. I don't think I'd recommend that approach, but if it works. Awesome. And I read somewhere you likened riding a bike to flying an airplane. I think your view is if you can ride a bike, you can fly an airplane. What do you see as the similarities between the two?
It's exactly the same thing. You know, bicycle makes its own gravity. That's why we can have little skinny rims with tiny little spokes. It's because we rarely, unless you're shrouding or something like that, you rarely put a side load on the bike. So when you lean into a corner and stuff, the gravity is right on, you're on the angle. Same as an airplane. You lean into the corners, you pull back on the stick, and you make your own gravity. It's all lined up exactly like a bicycle. The only difference is that you can carve your own path. You want to go around the clouds, you can go around the clouds. You want to go up and down or upside down. But it feels like you're riding a bicycle on a big, gigantic foam pit. It's pretty wonderful.
Sounds pretty good. Yeah,
it is.
I'll have to give it a try. Yeah, give it a try one day. So before mountain bikes, then you got quite into motorbikes and cars, I think.
Yeah, when my friends used to make jokes, I liked anything with wheels and a motor on it. So We lived in a neighborhood. Everybody, all the children were about the same age, and so we banded together in a closely knit tribe of hooligans, and we got engines and wheels and bolted pulleys and sprockets to them, and we made our own go-karts. And when motorcycles came, we all started riding motorcycles, and I thought it was going to be them for the rest of my life, racing and building them. I worked in a place that made motorcycle exhaust systems for many years and transferred around to different companies that did the same. And I had a fab shop that built high performance stuff for motorcycles and cars. And that was my life. I thought I'd be smelling race gas and listening to loud engines. But it wasn't going to be. At one time, I realized that first of all, I was starting to get tired of the noise and that crowd. But second of all, I went out to the desert to just play around on my motorcycle one day. And this encampment that I used to go to regularly was just beautiful. It's a little alcove and the granite boulders, and there's plenty of green around there. And I looked around and there was no green whatsoever. All the bushes had been pit motorcycled away, and there was trash and stuff around. And I looked around the rest of the desert and there was trails everywhere. And the whole landscape had been altered by myself and those who followed me. And I thought to myself, you know, I don't want to be part of this anymore. So I stopped that whole thing and went back into a different line. I thought maybe I'll go to college and learn to be a preschool teacher, because I thought maybe I could make some contribution by designing a preschool curriculum for boys, because as it's been said before, almost all of the early school curriculums are for girls, because they learn faster and they're more mature and their brains develop faster than boys. So I thought it'd be fun. And I got a job at a bicycle shop.
Yeah.
Fullerton Schwinn. And assembling Christmas cruisers for $1.75 each with air wrenches. As fast as I could put them together, they sold them. And it was wonderful. I was surrounded by cycling. I was going to college. I was a complete misfit, because I'd been in the industry all that time, you know. So I was welding since I was my second year of high school. I had a job as a welder. So I was, in a way, I was more ready for the world. But in the other way, I had missed a large chunk of it. So that's how I got into cycling.
Yeah. And you moved from there to a company that were making road bikes, yeah?
Yeah. Man that used to come into the bike shop. By this time, I'd gone to Schwinn School and I'd become a certified mechanic, and I was well into it. And he was a painter for Medici Bicycles, and he told me that they were looking for somebody with skills, and I had it. And I thought, hey, this would be a wonderful job. It turned out to be a wonderful job, but it was a lot of work, and it was about 22 miles away, and we had to start work at 7:30, so... At the time, I was a B-level road racer, and I used it as a commute 4 days a week.
Fair play.
Middle of the night. know, going across town on with the big rigs and stuff. And the good part was that there's a giant bakery halfway to work, and all the trucks. I motor paced the trucks all the time, and they got to know me. So they would moderate their speed and run red lights to see how long I could stay on their tail. And so it made this 7 mile stretch of 6-lane roadway into a unbelievably fast stretch. I mean, they would honk their horn and run, and I'd be right looking at their apportioned license plates on the trailer. So anyway. But yeah, I learned how to do the classic steel and lug frames from John Simonetti at Medici Bicycles, and started as a filing lugs as a grunt, just like everybody else. And it was quite an education.
Yeah. And you, obviously you were riding on the road a lot at that point, and you started kind of spicing up your road rides, adding in a bit of dirt track, linking sections up. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing about the road is you need to use a lot of it to stay in shape. Otherwise you got to sit down and do a stationary trainer, but in Southern California, you can ride every day. You know, the rains, it's just kind of fake rains. You guys in the UK wouldn't understand it. We don't do anything in the rain except for laundry and taxes because need a day of rest, right?
Yeah.
So at some point, you've gone like 100 miles in every direction on every single road that's worth cycling on. You know every gear shift. You know every your time for every hill. And it just turns all of your training days into just drudgery. And I think Greg Minar said that. Somebody asked him what he doesn't like, and he says training. And you think that he wouldn't say that because, you know, he's a consummate professional, but he just said flat out, he goes, you know, it's just the same thing over and over again. And I heard about a local cyclist that was going over the mountain passes on dirt roads on his road bike. And I thought, you know, I wonder if I could do that. So I started going over these passes, and it was just hell. But, you know, I was running sew-up tires, tubular tires, and they're really resistant to punctures, you know, rock punctures and stuff, because they don't have harsh, hard rim edges like clinchers do. So they wouldn't go flat. I wasn't getting any flats or anything, and I started doing the passes. And I do my 100-mile training rides with the dirt roads in between them and these monster climbs. It was like the old Tour de France pictures you see. And I remember I was still working at the bike shop when I was doing this, when I started. And I was at Medici Bicycles now, and I was thinking, gosh, if they came out with aluminum rims, I could make my own like big wheel, you know, 26-inch wheel bicycle with gears on it and stuff. And I could do these passes a lot better. Because, I mean, I remember one time when you got, okay, so there's no clip-in pedals. You have toe clips, and you wear track cleats because they're really deep. The cleats sit on the edges of the pedals, and you use fiberglass-reinforced toe clips so that you can put 100% power, because you're back then, I think a 21-tooth cog was the largest cog you could buy. And we were running a 50 chain rings. And so I was climbing these mountain passes in big gears. So you really needed to pull as hard as you could up and down to get through the sandy sections on the steep climbs. And so getting back, like once you fell over, because you didn't get out of your cleats on the slow section, you would slip out on a couple of sandy things or slip out on a rock, and then you finally get bogged down. And so at this point, you'd be out of your toe clips and standing on a mountain bike, or you'd be unclipped, or you had flat pedals and your feet would be out. But no, on a road bike, you're on the ground sideways, reaching for the little straps. So to get back on, you have to get moving fast enough to get your other foot back into the pedal and clipped in, reach down, tighten up the strap, and then have enough momentum to power up the hill. Well, after falling over like four or five times, I was so exhausted and so frustrated. I sat next to my bicycle on the edge of, it was Coal Canyon Road. It was two-thirds of the way up at the switchbacks, sobbing. I was just crying like a baby. And I thought, there's got to be a better way to do this. So when Ukai and Araya came out with aluminum rims for beach cruisers, for the fancy beach cruisers, I went back to my shop, which I still had, and started building my first bicycle.
What was that at that point? Was it a road frame just with some kind of bigger tires, bigger rims put onto it?
That would explain what every mountain bike was back then.
Yeah, okay, yeah, fair play.
Tom Ritchie and Gary Fisher were making mountain bikes. It was before the Stump Jumper, but the mountain bike pioneers had, like Joe Brees, had started to build custom bikes already. And So it looked pretty much like a road bike. It still had a straight top tube. It was a smaller frame, longer wheelbase, but it did look basically like a road bike with mountain bike tires and flat bars on it. You know, you begin with what you know. You know,
yeah.
If you think about it, you know, each generation builds on the knowledge that they had previously. So it took a while for geometry and correct angles and things like that to appear. Bikes and made them a little slower handling and made some more room for big fat tires and called it good.
Yeah. And was there anyone else where you were kind of doing that? Were there people to ride with that were in a similar mindset at that point in time?
At this point, there's a guy named Monty Ward, who I eventually became best friends with still to this day. And he was the head of the mountain bike world in Orange County. So I think there were seven of them. And they had started switching three-speed and some Schwinn frames over to 650Bs and then putting motorcycle bars or BMX flat bars on. And that's how they got started. And he bought, I think, the number seven Ritchie mountain bike that they built. So he was the vanguard, and that's where I first got wind that the mountain bike thing started.
Yeah. And at some point you decided that it would be a good idea to start your own bike company. How did that come about? And then how did you approach doing that?
I would love to say that I had this brilliant business plan and I sat down and figured out the costs and stuff, but the reality was, I was so stoked on mountain bikes. I'd already had a fabrication shop. And I thought, well, you know, I didn't do so well in my fab shop. I barely made, you know, money at all on it, but I kept a living. Maybe I could do really good with this. And I thought, you know, with this, it's a brand new sport. So really, if I do this right, you know, I can help kind of shape it. I'll be on the cutting edge, which is, you know, that's a rare thing. If you were like on the cutting edge when skateboards exploded, some of those people like made an entire career out of it. And I thought, okay, let's give it a shot. So I just started making bikes. My next door neighbor, Mark Grayson, he was a pretty good welder and he was also a fabricator from a different line of business. And he threw in with me and together the two of us made bikes for like 3 years together. And we didn't make any money, but it was still amazing because every person you sold a bike to wasn't just buying a bike. They were like buying into a sport. So we did rides and, you know, taught people how to ride bikes. And at some point we were pretty destitute and Mark said, I've got to eat. I've got to do something else in my life besides chew on bread rolls that are left over from the sandwich shop next door for dinner, which actually did happen many days. And so we parted ways and he went on to design bicycles for himself and for a couple other companies. And at that point, it looked pretty bleak, but I stuck with it because I figured this was my last chance to make something work as a personal businessman. And some wonderful things happened later on down the road. And that started a career. It was like, it actually worked.
Yeah. And that was Mantis Bikes. Yeah.
Yes. It was Mantis Bicycle Company.
Yeah. And mountain bikes, there weren't any rules then, I guess. No one knew what a mountain bike should look like. It was all, I guess, experimental. Did that make it harder or easier to design bikes and to put things out there?
Well, at first it was really hard because we knew what we wanted. You know, we wanted long seat posts so that we could have sloping top tubes, and we wanted wider bottom bracket axles so that we could have shorter chain stays. But the manufacturers that made all those parts, they were just cranking out road stuff. And they didn't really take us seriously. So there was only a few places where you could get those parts, or you had to make them yourself. And that actually dictated what mountain bikes looked like in the beginning. You needed chainstays almost 19 inches long so you could get clearance for the narrow bottom brackets and cranksets that didn't have any offset in the arms. And seat posts, the longest you could get were 260 millimeters. So the top tubes had to be pretty far up there, you know? And you start putting all that together. And the other thing was that nobody stocked parts for mountain bikes. So you had to sell complete bikes. So you, we got cranks from France, from TA. We had, cause they had the only triples that had low enough gearing, brake levers from Agura in Germany, derailleurs from Hiray and Suntour. And it just goes down the line. I mean, all these different companies with these little niche things. The shifters were left-hand shifters from Schwinn for their five-speed singles chainring bikes that we would switch. We put one on each, and they were out of production. So you call up Schwinn stores and buy every one they had. So you get like 30 sets of, you know, 30 or 40 of these things in an old box that was sitting in a Schwinn store, and they'd sell them to you for nothing. And then you get a call. Somebody would call you that was building bikes, you know, Ross Schaefer is from Salza, like, hey, have you got any of those thumb shifters? I don't have any. And so I'd run out of fork blades, and I'd call up Tom Ritchie and go, Tom, I'm out of fork blades. Have you got any? And he says, I can spare like six. And so I could sell six bikes because you needed a fork, you needed the components, everything in order to sell a bike. Sometimes they'd be on the wall with no shifters waiting or amazing. No crank. So at that point, no one was making money, but we didn't care because we were building the sport. I mean, we were making something happen that was just, we knew was absolutely wonderful. So anybody that we could turn on to the sport was like, one person more, you know?
Yeah. When did it start to get a little bit of traction enough traction for some of those manufacturers to start paying a bit of attention and making componentry that was in some way suited to where you guys wanted to head?
We owe that to Suntour and a small group of component makers that they knew. And we owe that to Specialized and Univeg, I believe. Those two pushed hard to get a group of dedicated components for mountain bikes. And they had the buying power to make it work. So when Suntour and SR and Sakai Ringo put together the first mountain bike groups, when the Stump Jumper, the original Stump Jumper came out, that put everything into motion. That got everybody looking like, oh, this is going to be a real sport. And the second point was, this is funny, RockShox, when Paul Turner made the first suspension fork, suddenly all the small builders made money because it took almost as long to build a rigid steel fork as it did to build a frame. And the cost that we were charging for a frame had the fork built into it. Mm-hmm. So when Paul Turner invented the RockShox, nobody cared about rigid forks anymore. And they paid the same cost for the frame. So all of the frame builders, we owe a debt. All the frame people that were still building frames back then, myself included, suddenly got this $200 bonus for everything we sold.
Fantastic.
And nobody even thought about it. And at that point, I started making money. Everybody started making money. We were rolling out. I had established a reputation for making unusual bikes that handled pretty good. So all of a sudden, I was in the chips. I had employees. I was paying taxes. It was wonderful. And we kind of owe it to another guy.
Yeah, if it works, it works, eh? And you had some pretty, you know, forward thinking ideas on some of the Mantis bikes. So I've seen stuff with elevated chainstays, something with effectively with a dropper post on it from kind of early 90s as well.
Well, the first dropper post was a Joe Breeze and Josh Angel, I think that was his first name. And that was that height right. And if you had a really smooth operating seat post and you set your height right up just right, it would actually come up at the correct riding height when you released your quick release on the seat post clamp. It would come up to your riding height and it would actually keep the seat straight. But that was a rare occasion. Most of the time that would happen. But it was the first true dropper. But I didn't invent that. My contribution, the elevated stays were because where I live, the mud is pretty, it's all clay, and it builds up around your tires like glue. And so we needed a lot of tire clearance in order to ride and throughout the winter. And there's no way to make the chain stays shorter with the constraints of the components that we had. So I just went over the top of that area, and then I could run short stays with tons of clearance, and it solved a lot of problems. And it wasn't the most efficient structure, but it made it so I could ride in truly any type of terrain. And that was the inspiration behind it. It was just to solve a problem.
Yeah, it looks fantastic. Yeah, there's a Pink Bike article about that. Is it the Valkyrie? Is that how you pronounce it?
The Valkyrie?
Yeah.
That's my favorite bike.
Yeah,
so I had been building aluminum bikes for a while. I switched to aluminum because it just made so much sense. And for a while, I bolted steel rear ends on because aluminum tubes had to be large diameter in order to have the same strength as steel. And it didn't make sense with the constraints we had in the rear triangle to use large tubes, because we barely had enough clearance for big tires as it was. So I went with steel in the rear so I could take advantage of the small tubes and screwed them together, which at the time was pretty wild because because most people think of a bicycle frame as one thing. You know, suspension hadn't come out yet. And people were like, hey, you can make a bike out of two pieces, you know? So that was the seed, I think, that helped get the average person's thinking moved over far enough so that we could do suspension and make some changes down the road.
Yeah, yeah. And you had a dual suspension Mantis, yeah?
That was the break point for me. So, you know, when I first started with mountain bikes, nobody really knew what a mountain bike was. So we had to actually go to dealers and put on slideshows with music and do, you know, basically meet with clubs and stuff and tell them about the sport. And one of the things that always came up with people would say, hey, why don't you just put a shock on the back and a fork in the front like a motorcycle and have a real mountain bike, you know? And I used to laugh at them like they were idiots. Say, you know, all the suspension a man needs is in the 10 inches in his arms and 10 inches in his legs. I mean, these things are light. You don't need suspension. Well, it turns out when you get tired, your suspension works poorly. So if you put it on the bike, the bike never gets tired. And when you have those bad days, you can still ride smoothly. So I realized at some point that suspension was going to work, but everybody else that I rode with thought it was a stupid idea. So I committed to it and ended up with this bike that Jody Weisel named because I couldn't figure out a good name for it. He was the guy that co-founded Mountain Bike Action and still is the editor in chief of Motocross Action. He's my mentor as far as that end of the world goes, but we'll talk about that later. Anyway, Jody said, let's just call it the Pro Floater. And I couldn't think of a better name. So I said, sure. And it was a really simple suspension design and I couldn't make them fast enough. There was a point where we were 500 orders behind all the time. And I have one upstairs, or excuse me, downstairs. And I still ride it, and it works pretty good. You know, it was a breakthrough in many ways. A lot of people still ride them, which scares me to death, because I still have the responsibility to cover that in case a lawyer calls and says, hey, you know that bike you built 30 years ago? Well, some guy just got hurt on it, and I want everything you own. Like, I live that fear now.
And that would, so that was one of the original full suspension bikes, yeah?
It was one of the first successful ones. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm not touting my horn here. It just came into place that way. And yeah. It was unusual. I mean, we had to have, fortunately, Paul Turner covered the fork thing. So I think my first pro floater had number 12. It had a hand stamped serial number on the fork. It was one of the original Mag 10s. I think it was number 12. Wow. And RockShox asked for it back because they didn't have any complete examples of it. And so they they wanted it for their museum, so I gave it back to them. But anyway, back to this. You had to have the shocks made. So a friend of mine, Clark Jones, from Nolene's, he built the shocks. And that took a while to figure out. A lot of oil all over the place. And it was like, you know, literally we had to figure out how to make pivots and all that stuff. And it was a good journey, but it worked out.
Yeah, big challenge. So you're running a bike business in a rapidly growing, I guess, at that point, sport. And you've got 500 back orders for bits and pieces. What drove you to then move from running a bike company to going to the journalism side of things and taking up a role at Mountain Bike Action?
Well, two things. So by now I kind of had a good reputation as a bike builder and a Vanguard designer, you know, doing things the wrong way sometimes, the right way other times, but Vanguard at least is a good word that covers it all. And I got a call from a woman named Barbara Mizuno, and she said, hey, we want to hire you to design bikes for Nishiki. And would you be willing to do that? And I thought, yeah, that'd be an adventure. So she got the necessary stuff done, and we came to an agreement on price and stuff. And it was when I first wanted to do the elevated chainstays. So I thought, wow, I could break the elevated chainstays as with Nishiki, you know. So I did that. I built the first elevated chainstay bikes for them while I was building them for myself. But I think I debuted theirs first. And it was an open window to what the rest of the bicycle industry was doing. I became a kind of a assistant product manager because I had to follow the designs to Taiwan where they're being built. I had to sit in on the meetings, and I had to do big sales dog and pony shows. And so I went from like into this new role, and I saw what it took to go full production. And I saw it, the future that I would someday not be welding my own bikes and designing my own bikes. I'd hire designers, and I would hire, you know, I would have to hire engineers and marketing people and stuff to take the next step. And as a small builder, my contribution to the sport was newness. You know, it was like, what new design, what new geometry, stuff that we still see today. But I envisioned that the larger companies were going to take over that role and make specific hardware and have special shocks made and take care of all of the improvements that a smaller business can't afford. You know, we have to do a lot with what exists in order to keep the cost within our reach. And I thought my role as a builder was going to be diminished and there would be no small builders anymore. Well, of course, I was wrong, but I thought I was right. So later on, Zapata Espinoza got an offer from, he was the editor of Mountain Bike Action, which was the Bible of mountain bikes at the time. And his boss, Jody Weisel, had been coming over to my shop quite often, along with Zap, to talk bikes, measure things, and talk geometry and stuff for their articles. And when Zap left, I got a call, and they said, hey, who do you know that might be a good editor replacement for Zap. And I was naming off these people, and my wife at the time, who worked beside me at my business, said, "Hey, you've been thinking about doing something new. Why don't you put yourself on that list?" And so I did. And the next day, I was in the office at High Torque Publications, sitting next to Jody Weisel. They were asking me if I was going to be the editor of Mountain Bike Action, what would I do? And so okay. I took the job. The money was reasonably good. But in order to do that, I had to sell my company and divest in all of my design contracts and the money that I was getting from some Asian manufacturers for being consultants and stuff. So I traded a six-figure job for for a five-figure job. And but it seemed like a great adventure, you know, like, and I don't think I would have taken that job because I didn't know anything about making magazines. I didn't know how to type, and I didn't know much about computers. But a friend of mine who was a bike shop owner had just given me a guitar out of the blue. He walked into to Mantis in the middle of the night because he knew I welded at night. And he says, "Hey, I don't know why I did this, but here's a present." And he handed me a 1967 Fender Telecaster electric guitar. And he said, "I hope you like it." And he walked out. So it's the kind of inspiration that happens occasionally. I thought I would take it to task. And I played the guitar when I was younger, but I totally sucked at this. I mean, I had to buy Ernie Ball's How to Play Guitar magazine and start from the beginning. And it was so hard to take these hands that had been working with metal and hacksawing and pounding and shaping to make them play the guitar. And it was so humiliating to suck at something when I was at the top of my game in another area, you know?
Yeah.
And it came slowly. And eventually I performed with Jay's band just for fun, did a song at a punk club one night. But when I got the call, I thought, you know, I suck so bad at guitar. I can do this. If I just throw my soul into this, I can figure it out. And I had a lot of help from my coworkers who typed my articles from written on yellow sheets of paper or dictated for a year while I came up to speed. And Jody, he sat down with me every evening, debriefed, and says, "Hey, you can do this better." And, you know, he's an extremely good mentor. He was hard as nails, but he was a good mentor. And eventually I figured it out. So,
yeah. What did you learn then? What do you think were some of the key things you picked up that have enabled you to be a top quality journalist in the field of mountain biking?
Well, top quality to me. what Jody taught me was it's a mathematical equation to write a story. So you only have so much space, you know, especially in print. You know, you have an exact amount of words and you have an exact amount of pages. You can make it hard for yourself and write War and Peace. Somebody's going to have to slice it back down to 800 words and four photographs. So you start with the math. You go, okay, four photographs is going to take up this much space. I'm going to have a big shot to lead with some smaller details and a chart with information. And that only leaves me 300 words. So that's all I have to write. Yeah. Well, writing 300 words when you ramble like you've just experienced I ramble was the big learning process, is to put all your thoughts in the smallest possible package and then add stuff that you need rather than subtract it.
Do you think that art's been lost a little bit with online, or do you think it's still as relevant today as it was then with print?
Well, good writing is still good writing, so it's still relevant. The difference is people can get all the information they want in a very short amount of time on the internet. And so you need to tell a story that's compelling enough to keep people reading it. And if it's not compelling, you need to have the common sense to shorten it down to the absolute minimum. So somebody can scan it in 3.5 seconds, get the information they want, move off to somewhere else on the internet, and still have enough of a hook. So if they say, you know, I didn't get what I wanted, they'll come back to your story. So yeah. It's a lot different style, but compelling writing is still the same. It has value.
Yeah. And how long were you at Mountain Bike Action for?
It's the years kind of, I don't remember. I think I was there from 1993 to 2010.
Okay. So yeah, good chunk of years then. So you've seen a lot of progress in the industry, but also a lot of change in the print industry as well, I suppose.
Huge. There has been a lot of change. Well, it was pretty much the demise of the print industry as well. But also in the sport itself. I mean, at one point, there's two ways to get information. There was the rider, the best rider you knew, who basically told everybody in your group what was good and what was bad and what worked and what didn't, what tires to pick. And they were the influencer. And then beyond that, it was the print magazine. And so there was still a kind of a religious order in the way that people got information. You either got it from your local guru or you got it from the church of print magazines, yeah. You know, and you had to wait for your response. If you didn't agree and you wrote a letter in, you had to wait a month and a half, 2 months to hope that some guy like me would say, you know, you've got a good idea there. I think I was wrong. By that time, everybody forgets about it, which is the great insulation that you have on with print. If somebody doesn't agree with you, by the time all the hate and stuff has settled and people have forgotten about it, the next issue comes out. So you're insulated from your readers emotionally. And when I started with Pink Bike, there's absolutely no veil between your reader the moment that your story is released and the emotional pluses or minuses that come with what your opinions were, whether you're right or wrong. That was a slap in the face.
Yeah. Did you find that hard to deal with? Because it's a massive change, isn't it? Because effectively in a lot of ways, you're still kind of doing the same thing, right? You're creating content that is being published. But like you say, in that respect, it's totally different world.
Yeah. I remember when I started with Pink Bike, I walked out of Mountain Bike Action because we had some disagreements about what the industry was doing and the language that we speak. You know, the days of a print magazine inventing names for things like, you know, black diamond writing and stuff. You can't. I mean, I came from a lot of different sports, and the people that invent the sport, the people that invented surfing, came up with all of the names for surfing, you know, what the moves were and stuff. Like, people that invented skateboarding. I mean, I would never name something an ollie, but everybody knows what an ollie is because whoever named it an ollie, that trick, invented it or watched it being invented. And so when Mountain Bike Action became lost track of the what the sport was doing, it happened during free ride. And I didn't like free riding because a lot of the stuff I did was land access. I mean, I started from the beginning at Mantis. I volunteered at state parks. I went to every single land access meeting. I led for 8 years. I ran all the volunteers at one of California's largest state parks, and that's cycling, equestrian, natural history, all of them. I ran all those groups, and we did all the trail maintenance and fought all the battles. So when it came to free riding, the thought of people just digging trails everywhere and, you know, building jumps and unraveling a lot of the work irked me. But I was wrong. Free riding was the soul of the sport had moved away from cross-country trail riding into free riding. And for the first time, mountain biking became a communal sport. You know, downhilling is communal because you ride the shuttle with your friends in the truck, or you ride the lifts, and you're always with different people. You're talking about the lines and stuff you did. But free riding was like super personal. You know, everybody stops and you session stuff together. It's like it became a tribal, more personal sport. And free riding was more than just hucking yourself off the biggest rock or log you could find. It was the fact that everybody hung out together while they were in the woods or on the trails and actually talked. We didn't just time trial to the top of the next climb, talk about where we were going to go next, time trial down to the downhill, meet at the bottom and talk about how cool we were. It was something we did together the whole time. And when I realized that, you know, I took some trips up north and rode with the buds in Squamish and the North Shore, not Squamish, but the North Shore. And I realized what free riding was. It was what mountain biking has always been, but better. So to bring it back to mountain bike action, my argument was that we can't tell the sport how to name stuff and what we should be doing. We should report on it because we don't have that authority. We belong to the previous group as a magazine, and we need to respect the new people. And that's why I walked, because we weren't relevant anymore. Yeah. And I wanted to be relevant.
And how did it feel then starting in with Pink Bike, publishing an article and having that immediate response on the forums?
It was scary. I'd been out for a year. And I saw that Pink Bike had hired Sterling Lawrence and Ian Hylands. And I'm thinking, what? You guys are hiring the best photographers in the business? You know, where do you get your money? And I was almost mad. It's like at this particular point, the people that had established mountain bike websites were like small potatoes. I mean, advertisers were giving them a bone occasionally, but they weren't paying like $15,000 a page like they were from the print magazines. And the quality of writing and stuff was pretty minimal. I mean, it was sometimes you'd see something really good, but most of the time it was pretty rough. And then here they are hiring these guys. So I called them up just to find out. I mean, it was like, oh yeah, I'll find out about this. I called up and Julia Coffey was their marketing guy. And he answers the phone and I go, he says, hi, my name's Julian. And I'm like, yeah, I'm RC, Richard Cunningham. And you're like, oh, yeah. So how are you getting the money to hire photographers like, you know, like Ian? And he goes, oh, well, we decided, you know, Pink Bike is this big community, you know, and we decided we should editorialize it. And we want to take the advertising away from the print magazines. I'm like, really? He says, does it sound like a good idea? And I said, yeah, it sounds like a really good idea, especially considering where I just came from. And he says, you want to be part of it? And I said, sure. And so like I got tickets in the mail to go up to Chilliwack, which is the hydroponic capital of and it gets the most rain of any place in the Pacific Northwest. And it's also completely supported by hydroponics. Yeah. So you know what they grow there. And so I got the job and Carl, after they said, okay, you know, I got the job, Carl says, okay, let's write a story and I'll show you excuse me. If you don't know Carl, Carl and Radek Burkhardt,
okay.
Radek started the site, actually wrote the code, and Carl is his younger brother. And he was the person who was, decided to run the business once they editorialized Pink Bike. So Carl is my big boss. Radek is the Lord God of Pink Bike. And Radek weighs 300 pounds and he's fit. He actually won an off-road 6-day race in Morocco and qualified for the Paris Dakar on his, and it's a 2-cylinder KTM. So he's unbelievably fit. And he also rides skinnies. It's like a lollipop on a bike. I mean, this guy is incredible. And when he gets on a bike, he doesn't look like he weighs 300 pounds. And Carl is an inch shorter, and his mother calls him tiny. But Radek is, I think, 6'4", and Carl is 6'5" or 6'4". I think he's a little shorter. So anyway, so Carl says, okay. So I wrote an article, simple text story, and we posted it on Pink Bike. And before I got final corrections on it, because you have to look and see what it is once it goes online, 700 people had written it, had read the story in 3 minutes. And it just kept going up and up. And the readership was, it went over 1,000. I thought, you know, 30,000 subscribers was what Mountain Bike Action had beyond the newsstand sales. And for that many people to read an article in just, you know, a number of seconds, I was just blown away. And it just kept going. I mean, you just watching the numbers up there, and then the comments started to come in, and I thought, uh-oh, this is going to take a big reinvention of my style. And I went home like humbled, like, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this?
It's a big change, a really big change, isn't it?
Oh my God. Like, you're directly connected to your readers, and you know, one person could start a string that could just demolish your article. And you can't fight that. You can't just go online and try to put out the fire. You have to actually sit back and go, okay, what am I going to learn from this? I was wrong on these 3 points. I could have done my homework a little bit better on that. So there's some truth in it. But on the other hand, no article is perfect. It's just, this is the first time where I was faced with the emotional trauma of being able to fix a story, but having to admit when I fix a story that I was absolutely wrong in the context of 15 minutes. You know, when you're wrong on print, you can wait it out. People will forget about it. You know, eventually your magazine will be used in the bathroom for cleanup purposes or something like that. And no one will have it. But on the internet, all of your mistakes are going to be there until somebody figures out a different code, and we've lost everything. And that might take forever. It was a big, you know, reading what bad people say about you in real time and what good people say about you in real time. It was a massive change for me.
And so would you still, like, did your approach to the comments section of an article change throughout your years at Pink Bike? Because it sounds like from the start you would read all the comments, but did that continue?
Yeah, I actually read all the comments.
Okay.
And you know, the negativity, I've never got to the point where I've been calloused enough so that the negativity doesn't bother me. Somebody says something hurtful, it hurts. Somebody mentions something that I did wrong, I'm like, oh, to this day, I'm like, you know, I could do better. I should. How did I miss that? You know, sometimes it's just dumb luck. You transpose a number and it's a key number and you read it 66 times and you don't see it because one of the things that you learn in print is that you can't proof your own work perfectly. You never proof your own work and get everything. And one thing that the internet doesn't really have is a good proofing system. I mean, we read each other's work, but we have a really fast timeline compared to print. In print, we had 4 levels of proofing. Professional proofreaders, we would all get together and reread our stuff. And when the final boards show up, when the magazine has actually been printed, but it's just the first one, we get to look at all those pages and make a final edit. And we do that in groups of like 5 very carefully. But in online, you don't do that. You run your story. Your fellow editors look at it. We read it. We proof it pretty good. and we send it out. And we know that we could fix something down the road. It isn't like a printed one. So there's always that, if something really goes wrong, we can change that. That's a big, a massive change. I wasn't ready for that. I didn't realize how much I needed people to watch my back when I started this online stuff. I made a lot of mistakes that were simple proofing errors because I was used to somebody going through it. Now, read my stuff too many times, probably.
But that's impressive that you still read the comments on the articles, because the forum can get pretty long on some of it, if it's especially on the technical topics, actually, which is be a lot of the stuff that you're writing. It can get pretty involved.
Yeah, but you know, there's an opportunity in that, because when people comment, they're either pretty passionate about it, mostly they're pretty passionate about it. I'd say there's a few people that comment just to a small percentage comments just for the flash value. Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunate, but it's life, you know, it's how there's always a joker in the crowd, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So, but I mean, it's a way to find out who you're talking to. I mean, you don't get that with print. In fact, that's one of the disappointments that I've discovered about being a journalist was that, and my friend Monty Ward's been a mentor for me in many, many ways. And so is Jody Weisel. And the two things I learned from those men was I got, you know, this great letter once about Mountain Bike Action, and I've read it out to my fellow editors. And Jody turns around and he has this funny little way of talking. He's like, yeah, just put it in your file somewhere and save it from when the bad one comes. You get 7 bad letters and you pull out that one and you can read it again and feel a little bit better. And he says, good letters, bad letters. He says, they're the same. He says, when people stop talking, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And then when I switched to journalism, Monty said, you're going to have some adjustments. He says, well, you make things, you've made things all your life. And when you hand those over to your customers or you look at it, it's something that's physical right in front of you. And there's some closure on that. He says, but as a journalist, you're going to be pushing against atmosphere. You're just going to be putting pressure on the world. And you won't know if you release that pressure, it just comes back to what it was before. You just have to put pressure on it long enough to make a difference. And you may not know whether or not you did make a difference for many years, maybe never. And it took me a while to realize how truthful it was. And Monty is in politics where you're doing a similar thing, but that's the one thing you don't get from journalism, or you rarely do, is to be able to look back and see for sure whether you've moved the needle permanently in any aspect.
Yeah. Interesting stuff. You've developed a bit of a reputation, I guess, for being able to predict the future, and you always seem to be a few steps ahead of the curve. What do you think it is that enables you to do that? Have you got lucky a few times and it stuck, or have you got kind of some perception from the, you know, just the general length of time that you've been involved with the sport that helps you see where things are going?
I won't be giving up any secrets, but I've been on the vanguard in a couple of different sports. You know, I started on motorcycles before there was motocross, or before racing became true. What we consider racing now happened. And so going through that, you see how a sport begins with pioneers and tinkerers, and it gets transferred into racing and competition, where those tinkerers and stuff now become more important and the larger companies move in. And there's an evolution that takes place in every sport. And if you see that pattern, if you don't look at the sport itself, you just watch that pattern, it's repeated over and over again in enthusiast sports. So okay. Once you recognize that pattern, you can see what's going to happen next many times with some clarity. And that's mainly what my secret is.
Okay. So like a pattern recognition, I guess.
Well, you know, we grow up, you know, the sport's no longer an infant. We were just talking earlier about how you know, at one time, everybody that was a mountain biker, everybody that had a mountain bike was a mountain biker. It was all inclusive. When you raced downhill, you raced it on your cross country bike. You raced cross country on your regular mountain bike. And then as we started branching off and specializing in sports, became a little bit more mature, at some point, you had to decide whether you were a racer or not. And racing got in the 1994, 1993, cross-country racing was king, but it became clear that nobody really wanted to ride cross-country bikes because they had all that crap. And you had to dress up in tiny little tights and stuff. And they weren't really that versatile. And one by one, the people that were really hardcore mountain bikers that rode trails and wanted technically better handling bikes, they started wearing water packs, and they started putting riser bars, and they disappeared. First, they were watching the races from the sidelines, and then they just stopped watching the races altogether and went and rode. And the sport fell apart at that point. And those people that left the sport and became trail riders again became the first free riders later on. And free riding kind of set us back and said, hey, we're doing this for fun. To push the envelope, and you know. So if you look at the sport and how it technically and physically changes, you can pretty much pick what the next path is.
So what do you think is next then? Have you got a kind of a feel for what the next 5 or 10 years looks like for mountain biking?
I pretty much do. One of the things that the internet has given us is the app. You know, people are thinking about new sports in a different way. They don't want to put in the time that it takes to become part of a community so much. They want to be able to get into it as quickly as possible. They're looking for the app that allows them to, you know, stream videos, the app that allows them to reprogram their car so that it goes faster. They don't want to learn about what makes the car go faster. They just want to be able to link their phone with a chip and go, okay, there it goes. So what has happened is that mountain bikes have become easier to ride.
Yeah.
Bad mountain bikes almost don't exist. You can climb, descend, and stuff on the same bike, which is fairly new for the sport. And that has made it more accessible for existing riders and for new riders. And another thing that we've done is we've invented and proliferated mountain bike-only trails. I mean, we talk about flow. Well, flow trails didn't exist. We started the sport on the backs of equestrians and hikers and peasants that needed trails to go from village to village. You know, we founded our sport on the backs of other trails builders and users. And then we developed our own trails now. So you can actually get on a mountain bike that's specifically designed to flourish on flow trails and features and go out there with minimal experience. So the new mountain bikes have basically become an app, and our trail systems have followed suit. So we have evolved from a community of cyclists to a community of backcountry users that ride bicycles. And once you become a user group, the landscape and the needs of the mountain bikers has changed. And that's why e-bikes have become quite popular, is because everything is in place. Now you don't need to be all that fit. So the e-bike is the ultimate app. It's like the vape pen. You know, you don't have to learn how to light a cigarette in the wind. You don't have to worry about the bad effects on your lungs from the burning paper and all that stuff. You just puff when you want and smoke comes out the other side. It's the easiest way to learn how to smoke. And the e-bike has taken away the one of the last challenges. And it's truly the mountain bike app now.
And you think that'll change the sort of people that we see in the sport?
Well, right now we're selling mountain bikes to mountain bikers. So we're fooling ourselves because we're selling an easier to ride mountain bike to people that have already been conditioned emotionally. They were part of a community. They understand the rules. But once we run out of mountain bikers, we're going to be selling them to people that are first timers in the sport. And without that information, that knowledge of how to treat others, other users, the rules of the road, we're going to have a much, I'm looking for a good word here. It's a much, an equally enthusiastic, but a coarser level of riders out on the trails.
Yeah.
And when that happens, we're inevitably going to see some conflict. Right now, there aren't enough e-bike users sharing trails to move the needle at all. But when that moment happens, when we hit that solution where we have enough e-bikes to move the needle, we'll also have to give up. We'll have to give up some land access and trails because mountain bikes and e-bikes have been wedded together for political reasons, and we can't unwed them. We can't untie them once we get to a certain point. So the land access issues that e-bikes create will be permanent losses for all the sport.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of it's a scary thought, really, but I tend to agree that, the trail access that we've fought hard for in the past is definitely at risk, I think.
Yeah, we can't stop it now. Now we're going to have to ride it out and see what happens. We can mitigate the losses later, but we're going to have to take a loss. And the reason for it is, right now we're all playing by the rules. You know, get the class one, the class twos and all that stuff, but there's nobody to say whether you're a class one or a class two. There's no education in the when you're a forest ranger or a land manager to tell the difference between the two. And they have to get faster, because if you're going to buy a $10,000 Specialized that has 250 watts, after you're done with that, are you going to buy the same model with the same 250 watts? And you're like, no, you're going to buy one that's faster, more capable, faster battery. That's human nature. So we're going to have to ride it out now and see how it goes.
Who do you think has the responsibility to kind of manage that situation? Because I can't really see where that falls.
It's going to be an organic process because we didn't address it when we started. We thought we would be able to self-regulate our sport. But history has shown us that we aren't leaders. We're all followers when it comes to that stuff. Where there's going to be no self-regulation. We're just going to push it as far as we can and then see what happens and then adjust later, which is how we've been managing our sport to date, really.
Yeah. So potentially some bumps in the road then.
Oh, we have to, it's not going to, it's a big change in the sport.
Yeah.
I mean, huge. It's when you can ride at about 10 miles an hour all the time, you pass through situations you can pass through a situation. There's a speed at which when you pass by somebody, there's very little recognition or interaction.
Yeah.
Once you take climbing out of the bicycle equation, you lose that period of time when you're going at the same speed as the people that are walking or riding horseback or using the trails in other ways. And so you're forced to look them in the eye and say, yes, I am a creep and I don't care about you, or no, I'm not a creep and I do care about you. But you have that moment in time where you're all on the same particular analog path, mm-hmm. and you have the eye contact but once you pass people at 10 miles an hour, it's just a high bye. And that insulation, you know, talk about the insulation I had as a print editor, that emotional insulation allows you to become more and more callous, regardless of what vehicle you're on. I mean, if you're trotting by on a horse at 10 miles an hour, you don't have time to care. You've got other things on your mind, like steering your horse or your bicycle.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, interesting times then. So what do you think then mountain biking is doing well at the moment, and what would you like to see it work a bit harder at?
I think that the basic mountain bike is unbelievably good. And one thing that I'm particularly proud of is the fact that mountain bike makers are pushing down the price of a mountain bike to a much more affordable level. We're seeing pro feeling cockpits and great pedaling bikes with good suspension, you know, $3,000-$5,000 that were unattainable just a short time ago. And the handling, the geometry, it's just, you couldn't pick a better time to be a mountain biker right now. You can ride anywhere. There's lift access, there's trail centers. If you wanted to be a mountain biker right now, this is the time. So I would say that technologically, the industry could have not done this better.
Yeah.
As far as what we could do better, I wish we had not overreached. What I think we could do better is to realize right now that the mountain biker is the top of the food chain on every trail center. And the industry itself needs to understand that. I mean, we've trained other users to step out of our way. Even other cyclists, when we're going downhill, cyclists jump off to the side like they don't want to disturb our flow, you know?
Yeah.
Because they know this is a form of recreation now. It's predominantly downhill recreation as it's evolved. And we've trained everybody to step out of our path, all users, and they do it with a smile. So that means they're the second or third generation of trail users that have learned to live with mountain bikes. And as we train them, you know, our, hey, thanks for getting out of our way is our thank you. But if you look at it from the other end, you know, somebody might only have one day to hike to their favorite peak or overlook or run their favorite trail run. And if they have to step out of the way of mountain bikers two or three times, it totally blows their flow. But we've accepted it, you know, and they've accepted the fact they're going to step out of our way. We've won. We've won this gigantic land access battle in a huge way, but we haven't given anything back. We haven't said, hey, you know, maybe we should step away from some of these multi-use trails and stay closer to the mountain bike specific trail centers. You know, we haven't made any concessions. We've won this victory. And we've now overreached slightly and said, okay, well, let's just electrify it and give this wonderful sport to more people without realizing that we have pushed a bunch of people who gave us this chance to ride with their trails very reluctantly 20 years ago. Yeah. We've forgotten about that.
And how do you think we should be addressing it? Like what would... your average rider, what would we do differently?
I think as an average rider, if you're on a trail center that's joint use, we should start giving way on the joint use ones and okay. accepting our role as top food chain on the mountain bike specific trails. I think we need to become the gentlemen and the gentlewomen in a situation where we're on multi-use stuff. Just take the step, even though it takes a bite out of your flow or whatever. It's no big deal to let a group of runners by, you know, just stop and go, especially if you're on an e-bike. I mean, if you're not paying for acceleration with your legs and lungs, so why not just stop? You know, make it, if we're sharing, we should take the high road from now on and make an effort to take the high road. And maybe that'll blunt the losses that we're probably going to have to incur later on.
Fair play. Yeah. Good advice, I think. Cool. All right. Well, we're getting close to the end of our time. So we'll wrap up with the four questions that we ask pretty much everyone. And the first of those is, if our listeners had £150, which I think is about $200 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend that on?
You gave me these questions ahead of time and I had some time to think about it. So I was thinking of all sorts of things. Tires. Yeah, I get to the best tires, but a helmet. Buy a new helmet. Get rid of that crappy one that you kept forever, because really it doesn't make, you can do wonderful things on a crappy bike, but if you lose your brain, you lose access to it, even a small amount at a time, that's the end of story. I mean, Stephen Hawking gave the world some amazing things and he could move his eyes in one finger, you know, but his brain was still working. So I'd say that's it. You know, it's your eyes are the window to your soul and your eyes are an extension of your brain. So when you see that disconnected look in someone, that's because they're disconnected from their soul. Their brain's not working. So buy a good helmet with your $200 and that'll get you to where I am at 66, where I can still ride a bike.
There you go. Have you got through a few helmets in your time?
Yeah. And I had a couple scares. I mean, a few years ago, I had a double concussion, 2 months away, exactly the same side, out of nowhere hit on the left side of my brain. And I had to take 6 or 7 months before my doctor said that I'm okay again. And it changed a lot. I play my guitar differently. My fingers work differently on the keyboards. And it was a big scare. It's like, okay, this is real.
Yeah. Yeah. Got to look after it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair play. All right. Second question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself, age 16, what advice would you give him?
Ask the dumb questions. How often do we not ask how to do something or what this means or how does this work? Because we're so egotistical, we don't want to show somebody that we don't know something. So we're afraid to ask the dumb questions. It's almost, to a man or to a woman, the smartest people I've ever met ask a lot of simple questions. And I was afraid to do that when I was younger. And I missed a lot of simple knowledge. Like, how do you manual? You know, show me again, you know, don't be afraid to be stupid. Just ask the dumb questions.
That's a good one. I like that. We've not had that before. And that's it's a really cool way of looking at stuff. Totally agree with that. All right. Third question. If you could have a coaching session with anyone, who would it be? And what would you want to learn from them?
Well, I have two answers to that.
Okay.
Growing up in a big family, I didn't get a huge amount of time with my father, and he was brilliant. That's what I learned all of my engineering from. I was a dreamer, and he was a product engineer, super sharp. He could visualize math in 3D, which I learned later. But I wish he had to reinvent himself a number of times. You know, he's in World War II. He started a family. He became an engineer. He raised his brothers and sisters when his father died young. And he went through aerospace and he was a bigot when I first met him, I was ashamed, and he completely reversed that. And he went into medical stuff. He reinvented himself a number of times, and it didn't wear him down. And I want to know how he did that, because I've had to reinvent myself a few times to stay relevant in this life. And they were major life changes. And yeah, it seemed easier for him. And the other one is, well, my father's gone. That's why I don't have that opportunity. Uh-huh. The other one would be on the cycling would be Nico Bouillot.
Yep.
I've spent a number of times with him riding and talking and stuff. And he thinks everything through. Nothing happens truly by accident. And when it does, he's like, oh, well, I could do this when I do that. And he never stops learning. And he can explain everything he does in really simple language. I wish I knew French, because his English is faltering and he's a little embarrassed to speak English, even though he speaks it well. But every time I've been with him, I've learned something incredibly useful. Like, I was watching him on an EWS video last year, and I noticed he was driving up the embankments on the switchback turns. Like, he'd go like 2 meters up the hill and then make his turn and then zip down the switchback. And I thought, that's so easy. You blow all your speed with altitude. You have plenty of room to turn. Then you get your speed back when you're on the downside. And I thought, yeah, I can do that. So Nico would be like, I would like to spend a year with him.
Yeah, same. I'll come on that trip. That sounds good to me. Cool. All right, final question then. What's one thing that you do every day that you feel benefits you?
That's easy. I play my guitar every day, even if it's just a little bit. And it's like, I think I've heard that music heals. And I think it's true. A little bit of music in your life, even if it's singing a tune or whistling but actually performing music, not just listening. I think everybody should do a little bit of that, because that's what keeps me alive.
Nice. I like that. Cool. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure learning more about your career so far in the world of mountain biking. And yeah, just really cool to speak to someone that's been there from the very start of it and been, you know, someone that's formed this awesome sport that we have around us. So yeah, thanks for your time and thanks for sharing. If people want to kind of keep up to date with what you're up to, where's the best place for them to look?
I'm still on Pink Bike. You can find me there. So, and I answer pretty much anybody that asks a question or says hi or something like that. I pretty much go into it. So
awesome. And you're still going to be doing the occasional bit of writing for them. Is that right?
Yeah, they want me to do a couple of think pieces now and then and some editorials.
Good. So you're not going to leave us.
No. My retirement is a partial retirement. I can't imagine myself leaving this sport. It's been the one thing I've never tired of in all of the activities I've done.
Awesome. Good stuff. Well, thanks so much for your time. And yeah, look forward to reading some more of your bits and pieces on Pink Bike occasionally.
Well, thanks, Chris.
Nice one. Cheers, Richard.
Cheers.
All right, that's it for this episode with Richard. I hope you've enjoyed finding out more about him. I could definitely have chatted with Richard for many, many hours, so maybe we'll get him back on for more soon. A massive thanks to KushCore for supporting this episode. Don't forget to check out what they have to offer over at KushCore.com. And if you want to be in with a chance of winning a set of your choice, then all you need to do is to spend a couple of minutes filling out my listener survey over at downtimepodcast.com/survey. That data is super important for me to understand how I can make the best content for you and to help me when talking to brands about supporting the podcast, which I need in order to keep this thing going. If once you've filled out the survey, you've still got a couple of minutes spare, then leave us a review wherever it is you listen to the podcast. Give us a follow on social media where we're at Downtime Podcast. Subscribe to the show so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to help support the podcast, then share the love at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, please keep on spreading the word, tell your friends about the podcast, and share our episodes on your social media. Okay, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon. But until then, look after each other. And if it's okay to do so, then get out and ride safely.